Good morning. I'll convene the House Education Finance Committee today. And with that, members, we have minutes. First order of business is the minutes of March 12th before us. Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, or Representative Purcell? Either one.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from March 12th, 2024.
Thank you. Representative Purcell moves the minutes of March 12th, 2024. Any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The minutes from March 12, 2024 are adopted. With that, members, I think Representative Edelson would like to give a shout out.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I just wanted to have my interns for a day stand up for me. Dinah are joining us. A group of high school students that it's my last group, my last session, and my last group of interns that I've brought. Now we're bringing 600 students here to the Capitol from our district. I just want to thank them for being here to learn more about government.
Thank you. And I know Representative Jordan has one a little bit later. Do you want to do it now?
Up to you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we can do it now.
Yeah, I also have a group of students here in the audience from Edison High School in Northeast Minneapolis, and amongst them are champion debaters who qualified for the state tournament. And Madam Chair, I am glad that I am debating all of you and not them.
Thank you. Members, we have our first order of business today. We're from Minnesota Department of Education. We're going to get an update on a unemployment insurance for hourly workers, and with us we have Kathy and Erickson, the Director of School Finance. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Kathy Erickson. I'm the Director of School Finance at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I will be giving an overview and an update on our unemployment reimbursement aid program that passed in the 2023 legislative session. Our overview is that we have a $135 million special revenue fund to help cover the cost of qualifying summer term workers receiving unemployment benefits. So these are non-certified staff who are eligible to file with deed in the unemployment department. And when those get approved, then school districts are billed for those on a quarterly basis, and then school districts will use this aid to help offset the cost of those new costs related to unemployment. The legislation took effect May 28th, 2023. So we did open up the grid for last fiscal year to include those costs from the day of enactment and through June. And then we will have additional costs in May and June of this year for the same fiscal year 2024. So we do have a slight overlap in the first year to allow for May and June of the prior fiscal year to be covered, as well as May and June of this year for fiscal year 24. These funds can be used until June 30th, 2027, or until the funds are exhausted. And we'll talk more about those component pieces. And the ability for eligible staff for summer term unemployment benefits would continue even after the funds have been exhausted. So this will remain in effect, where districts will be responsible for the payment of unemployment even after if the funds should be exhausted. Districts are not able to levy for any of the summer term unemployment. There is regular unemployment for staff members that is eligible for an annual levy, which is called reemployment on our levy limitation and certification. But this specific summer term unemployment cost may not be levied on districts' individual levy limitations and certifications. Districts are also not able to use reimbursable fund options to code these expenditures in order to get both the aid and an additional potential reimbursement until the funds are exhausted. So right now, what we have at School Finance is that all districts submitting expenditures right now will get 100% aid reimbursement for all of those submitted costs through the aid, so there's no reason to add any extra eligibility at this time. Districts have to pay the majority of the annual unemployment costs in November, but the process relies on final data that we get as the final submissions through their finance submissions at MDE. And unemployment specific funds will be looked at and finalized in January of 2025 for actual costs. So we received estimates right now where we were able to disperse some funds, but it'll always be based on actual reported expenditures by our LEAs, and then we will adjust any payments to that actual amount. That will be January of 2025. In October, we did a survey. We actually did two surveys this past fall to collect information from our LEAs, which are charter schools and school districts, intermediates and cooperatives, to find out how many eligible staff applied and their estimated amount of expenditures. Because of the timing of their bills versus the timing of when we get validated data to make a payment, we asked for this survey so we could provide a state aid payment at the end of November to coincide with these first bills that would be coming out from DEED and unemployment. This survey that you see here is a summary of the results. Of the eligible LEAs that were 553, we received 483 responses. You can see that 99% of our traditional school districts and 100% of our intermediates responded, and we had about between 70 and 75% responding from our charters and cooperatives. Also, you can see under the expenditures that we received estimated expenditure costs of just over $40.1 million for this past fall, knowing that we still will have some expenditures that haven't yet been recorded and reported for May, June, which will be the second quarter of this year, 2024. So we know that the overall cost for unemployment for school districts in 2024 will be slightly higher than what you're seeing here today. And you can see that we asked LEAs to submit their estimated number of eligible staff who received unemployment. And you can see that there was 17,866 estimated at this point in time. In this first survey, we also then sorted the submissions by the cost. And what you see on this screen is the top 10 largest estimated submissions by district, with St. Paul being the highest of just slightly over 2 million, Minneapolis following just shy of 2 million at 1.95 million, and then down to Robbinsdale, which was our 10th largest district at about $627,000. You can see their estimated eligible staff based on their submissions. And what percent of the total 40.1 million was their submission in relation to the larger total cost? So you can see that St. Paul Public Schools is being estimated at about 5.1% of the total of the 40.1 million that was surveyed. And again, keeping in mind that we do expect that the overall cost for 2024 will be slightly higher than that due to May and June submissions we don't yet have. The unemployment survey results here again in summary so that you could see it as average cost by eligible staff person with the total expenditures of just over 37.5 million and 16,325 reported eligible staff receiving benefits. The average cost per staff person was about $2,300. And then you can see those relationships between charter schools, intermediates, and cooperatives based on their submissions. Please keep in mind, again, that these are submissions that are unvalidated. These were estimates, and we will be getting final information at the end of the fiscal year once this is over. We had an average of $1,916 per person who submitted and collected unemployment benefits this past summer. We also have noted the 10 largest charter submissions by cost based on how they submitted. We have approximately 181 charter schools in Minnesota. We did receive notice from some that they did not actually have any unemployment cost for here. So the charter school submissions may not be for every district because they did not have any staff who applied or qualified for unemployment. But again, you can see the total cost. Our highest district charter school was Eagle Ridge Academy at 51,000 and 21 eligible staff, down to an average of 26,000 for our smaller charter schools. We were asked by the legislature as part of the legislation to provide information related to the total unemployment by employment category. So in November, we deployed a second survey so that we could get this information to provide in our legislative report that came out in January. And you can see here that districts did submit some updated dollars, so we're not getting the same exact totals as we did for survey one. We did have slightly less response rate than we did on the first survey. So you can see of the districts, LEAs, charters, co-ops and intermediates, we received about 38 million in responses this time versus the 40, but that was just that we did have some LEAs that did not submit. But you can see here, by far, our largest amount of staff who the districts and LEAs reported, 68.27% were paraprofessionals, 12.39% were our food service workers. We have transportation workers, bus drivers and others. Then we have our clerical, and then our operations and maintenance, and then other staff. These categories were chosen just by our UFARS coding so that we were able to deploy and get that information when we do our validations. And again, you can see that we have slightly different amounts, but overall, I think this would be an average trend if we were to put the full 40.1 million into play. My last slide is just an overview of the timeline of the process so everyone can get a sense of where we have been and where we are going. So our UI law was enacted May 28th, 2023. Eligible non-certified staff submitted unemployment applications to DEED. And I do want to say thank you to my colleagues at DEED for all of their help and support in being able to answer questions to our LEAs, our school districts, and others. They provided technical support and other information so that districts could understand how that submission process was working for unemployment. And then LEAs validated staff UI submissions. Once those were submitted to DEED, then districts would receive those, and they had an opportunity to review all of the applications for benefits and work through those, and would reach back out to DEED if they had any questions and concerns related to those. As I shared already, in October and November, we deployed two surveys to collect information because we don't actually get validated UFARS information until November or December of 2024 for last year. So we wanted to be responsive to our districts and make sure that they were eligible to receive some revenue, and then also to be able to provide that information to you in that legislative report from January. In January of 2024, we did provide the report to the legislature on estimated costs by unemployment category. And in that report, we have every district. So in my presentation, I showed the top 10, but in the legislative report and supplemental documents, there is all of the districts and charters, cooperatives, and intermediates in that list. By June 30th, 2024 will be our end of our fiscal year. So the expenditures reported from May 28th, 2023 through June 30th, 2024 will be adjusted to actual in January of 2025 due to our submission process and our portal here at MDE. And then in October and November this fall, we will do that second year survey to again support an aid payment and get expenditures for the annual report to the legislature. And then again in January of 2025, our first year final adjustments to actual be reported to MDE. And with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Kathy Erickson. So with that, we'll go to member questions, but I just want to point to some information in your packets. You have the report that Director Erickson mentioned. We also have a spreadsheet that talks about, oops, sorry. We have a report in the packet. We also have a spreadsheet that breaks it down by schools. And I'm going to ask like two quick questions just so I'm sure I understand. Like I look at one of my districts in Hopkins, and the numbers of employees are about the same as the surrounding areas that could qualify, but the cost was very low. But I also know that our district supplies summer school for some of the surrounding districts. So they had the ability to give people a chance to get a job, to continue their work. Is that one of the reasons why you could see discrepancies, large discrepancies between districts?
Madam Chair, yes. We noticed that for certain districts and charters throughout the state, Many had different varying times where some staff may have participated in teaching summer school or other summer programs that ended, say, in July, and then took a shorter amount of time for unemployment reimbursement. And then we had others that maybe didn't participate and then were able to have a larger amount. I do want to note that, you know, we did get feedback from some of our districts that some of the information will be updated when they do their final validation. So in the process of providing us information, some of this information may have been estimated, and we'll get that actual here again at the end of the fiscal year.
Thank you. And then another quick question I thought about, too. I heard you earlier in your presentation say districts have been 100% reimbursed for the cost so far that they've submitted. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, we asked for an estimate, and we did pay out 90% here, and then before the end of the fiscal year, we'll be working with making that final payment. Because of the estimates, we wanted to make sure that if any district wanted to adjust their estimate, that we would be able to cover that cost. So as of November 30th, we took 90% of the list that you see here today and distributed that as an initial aid payment.
Thank you, Director Erickson. That sounds very prudent. And final question, too, because I know we had to look at the tails when it came to special education, because many of our paras actually work in special education and districts would normally build towards SPED. At what point does the special education formula begin to incorporate some of these costs, and how will that impact reimbursement out of the school UI aid account? Because I know there's some different levers that are working there at play.
Madam Chair, this is a great question. The statute does not allow any district to claim any special education costs under UI until all of the aid has been exhausted. Looking at our trends, as we got our first survey back of the estimated $40.1 million, we are working and looking at what we think the trends are for fiscal year 25 and 26. But based on what we see right now, we would suspect that by the end of fiscal year 26, we would exhaust all of the $135 million. And at that point, then fiscal year 27 would most likely be the first year that school districts could then submit expenditures under special education, which would be eligible for reimbursement costs, which is then the prior year. So those would be applied towards fiscal year 28.
Representative Erickson, just one. Representative, I'm sorry I demoted you. Director Erickson, one other quick question, because if I can remember right, we put some money in the tails just for that purpose. I don't know if anybody remembers the number, if I should ask Mr. Strom or Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. So I believe the question was about how much money was set aside in fiscal years 26 and 27 from your target budget from last year. I believe that the dollar amount was around $64 million per year that was attributed to that. I cannot recall if that made it into the final bill.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. And maybe if you can follow up on that, I'm pretty sure it did. In fact, it might have grown a little bit. But, okay. Thank you. Sorry, getting distracted. Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you. So my question is actually a little bit of, and I, this might be, I'm not sure who can answer this question, but I do know that it just comes up when we're talking about the UI fund. Is there someone who can explain how summer school is paid for, and kind of, because I know that like something that has come up is like, oh, well, why can't we just offer more summer school positions to people? So can someone explain how districts get their funding and why some districts get a certain amount of money for summer school and some districts get less?
I think I'm going to toss that to Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Sensenbrenner, Ms. Erickson would be glad to help with this question as well. Since 1987, summer school has been funded outside of special categorical, and the thing that's used primarily is extended time revenue. And in order for a district to receive extended time revenue, it has to operate the program as an area learning center or area learning program style of program. That means that districts have to band together, except for the first class cities, in order to offer that program. It means that the classes that can be offered need to fit the criteria for ALC programs, so they can't essentially be enrichment classes or an additional foreign language or something like that. They'd have to essentially be classes to keep students on track. So there's limitations on the types of classes, there's limitations on the funding. It's capped, the extended time enrollment is capped at an additional 0.2 pupil units, so a fifth of a pupil unit to pay for the summer programming. So those are the main limitations on summer programming. The revenue is limited to the extended time revenue, which is a formula amount times 0.2. A maximum of 0.2 pupil units based on the hours served, and also that the district offers the program through its ALC program.
Representative Sensenmura, follow-up.
So I'm wondering, would it be possible to get, like, some kind of breakdown of, you know, how many pupils across the state were offering summer school to, you know, broken down by district? And then I also know that it sounds like summer school programs vary in terms of length. You know, is there just kind of some way we could get a better understanding of how much summer school basically we're offering the students?
Madam Chair, thank you. The majority of the extended time revenue is for summer school, but it may also be used for things like extended school day or extended school year during the course of the regular school year. So the pupil count that we have that's assigned to that goes to all of those things, but the vast majority of that is for the summer session. It's based on the hours, and each district can choose to offer a program. Maybe some are going to offer 5 days a week for 6 hours a day. Others may offer a 4-day-a-week summer program for 1 or 2 weeks more. So that design is all there. I'm happy to send you a printout, but keep in mind that because of the ALC structure, generally the host for that ALC is going to show all the spending. So you may see, for example, Detroit Lakes carrying a very large number, and its surrounding districts that are in the ALC with it carrying zero. It's really because Detroit Lakes is the host for that ALC, and it may have programming in more locations than just Detroit Lakes. So that's a short answer to that, but we're happy to provide you with that number by district, so you can see the extended time pupil count and revenue by district.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director Erickson. Just a couple questions of clarity. So in your last slide, you talked about June 24. That's not included in the about $40 million that's been out or spent so far. Am I understanding that correctly?
Director Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, just the amount of time between the end of the school year, where we have some districts who end in May and June, so those, there's just about maybe a month and a half of potential unemployment expenditures that are not yet reported.
Representative Bakeberg, follow up.
Thank you. So the districts that are offering summer programs in June or in July and August of 24, how does that play into this?
Director Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will have that third quarter billing, so from July, August to the start of the school year, any of those eligible unemployment expenditures will be on the third quarter, so that will be a part of fiscal year 25's expenditure costs.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your survey results, did the department ask for specific feedback from the school districts on the impact of this bill on their summer programming? Meaning, were they able to offer more programming, less programming? Was there any feedback on the impact on programming and ultimately kids?
Director Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did not ask those questions.
Representative Bakeberg, follow up.
So that would, I think that would be a fantastic addition to future surveys, to be able to get just accurate factual impact on our local school districts in an anonymous manner that they can just be transparent about the impact. Because as I, you know, and I would just back up and say, my mom was a para, and she intentionally chose to be a paraprofessional. Because she wanted to work with kids, number one, but she also wanted the schedule. So we put $135 million into the UI. That's about a 1.5% formula increase that we chose intentionally to not put on the formula and to put into this UI benefit. We could have put it into the READ Act to invest in literacy. And I saw that 70% of the people 70% of the people participating in it are paraprofessionals. And it would be great to have the data to see how did this program impact the programming in schools, because those paraprofessionals are the ones that are working with our kids in our summer programming to be able to get our kids caught up in reading. So this was an intentional, we allocated funds for this, and but we could have done about a formula and a 1.5% increase on the formula. We could have put $135 million toward the READ Act. We chose not to do it, and I think that's a mistake.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. Director Erickson, real quick, when there's a lag time when schools, the reason why you were doing the survey was so that you could get money out of the door quickly. Is that accurate, Director Erickson?
Madam Chair, yes. There is some conflicting language in the statute right now that we intend to correct, but we are only able to do final validation once we get those UFARs, and we do not get that information until December 15th following the fiscal year.
And Director Erickson, you're not here from Deeds, so I can't ask you this question, but maybe it's a follow-up for later. I know there's also a lag between businesses or districts that are actually charged, so that bill does not come due immediately. With that, I think I have Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Erickson, for being here. This is the law. We're a finance committee. We will be dealing with finance and as resources get allocated and expended. So, Mr. Strom, a quick question. Just I'm pretty sure I'm clear on this, but I just want to put on the record. So we allocated $135 million in the UI fund. That can only be used in the UI. That's a categorical, right? I can't. And the scenario would be I couldn't. You mentioned extending time revenue. If I wanted to offer somebody a job and extend their employment through the summer, I cannot tap into these to do that. I have to go to other categoricals, general fund, extended time. Is that correct?
Mr. Shaw.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, that's correct. This fund is only for reimbursement for that purpose through the end of 27. It's set aside one-time appropriation in 24 that's set aside through the end of June 30th, 27, and that money is only for the reimbursement of the claims. So couldn't be used for other purposes if a district were to design its schedule or its summer employee practices separately or differently.
Lead Kreisha.
Thank you. And so with that, is what we look forward, looking ahead, because we will have, this committee will exist again next year with a different budget cycle. We get back to 2-2, maybe, get back to days of not this large of one-time funding that we saw. We'll be in a situation where, let's say we have to put 2-2, or whoever's in this committee, they have to put 2-2 on a formula. If they don't allocate to the UI, those UIs will have to come from a different place. That's correct, right?
Mr. Strong, do you want to look in your crystal ball?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, it gets cloudier. the short answer is yes, with the exception of about half of the employees who are going to be in the special education formula. Those ones, once the special ed funding picks up, Ms. Erickson could speak to this, but I believe about 80% of the paras are expected to be special education paras.
Okay.
And so then their costs, and that's about half of the total employees that claimed in the survey data. So their costs then would roll through the regular special ed formula for each district. And presuming an average district gets 60% of their special ed funding through the direct funding, and then half of their cross subsidy picked up once we get to that point in 26, then really about 80% of half of the employees would be covered through the regular special ed reimbursement. So it'd be the other employees outside of special education paras, and that 20% of special ed costs that would not be covered.
Thank you, Lee Kreisha. One more follow up.
Yes, thank you. Just a couple quick things. So, and what I'm really trying to set the stage for is our conversations down the road. And Director Erickson, maybe you can. So, assuming fast forward 16 months, whoever the legislature is, well, let's say we've allocated, or there's been allocated $700 million, which is a number that $700-800 million sometimes is a big one. If we don't, if that legislature doesn't set $135 million aside, those dollars are going to have to be accounted for somewhere else, because this will still exist. It's the law. That's what just happens. But what I'm really looking for is, I'm thinking, is that puts that legislature or that governor in the position of either earmarking for the 135 or letting it come from local scenarios or the general fund. Could we move general fund to pay for this?
Mr. Strong.
If we had to?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshak, yes, the general fund is the fund that's used to pay unemployment insurance. Sure. And a district, if its costs aren't covered by this formula or for those permanent staff layoffs that are covered through the levy, would then use its other general fund money to pay the cost. The cost will still be owed through the UI system payments. The school districts are reimbursable employers, so they don't pay a tax rate. They pay their costs into the UI fund on the reimbursement basis. And in terms of thinking about this on a per pupil basis, the expenditure of the $40 million is about $45 per pupil on an ADM basis, slightly more less than that on a weighted pupil basis. So if you think of half of that falling into the special ed realm, you're thinking about $22 per pupil unit for every year. If the funding were to run out and there were no appropriation separate to replenish that fund.
Got it.
Thank you.
And I do have one question.
We're just doing an overview, and some of these questions can be taken outline. I don't want to relitigate UI right now, so we just wanted to get a report. Yep. But go ahead, Lee.
And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And I'm not trying to relitigate. I'm really just looking ahead, and I just want to get them on the record. So here's what I'm seeing, and as I'm thinking ahead for whoever's on this committee, we have a scenario. This is the law. Directing forward, we would have to earmark and appropriate, so it's there. I get that. My question and these are things we may even have to fix. We can't move money from UI to general fund, but we can go the other way. So we create a scenario where a school district, if they're balancing the budget, may be making difficult decisions about where they're going to put the money. Like, for example, if school districts could pay people to do things over the summer, they can't draw from the UI, but they can draw from their general fund. So we create an imbalance there, and we put districts, I'm just trying to help them. I'm not trying to take the program away. I'm just trying to make our districts get there. So my question is two things. Do you think it would be beneficial to allow some flexibility there, Director Erickson? And the second thing is, just so we know, what would be the process in case, and I hope there isn't, in case there's a fraudulent claim, at least in case somebody tries to use this in ways they shouldn't. Does DEED handle that, or does that come back on you?
Director Erickson, the second question was more directed to you. The other one was a hypothetical. I don't feel comfortable letting the state agencies answer. Director Erickson, do you want to talk about the fraud oversight?
Madam Chair, Representative, our intention after each validation year in working through these processes with that there could be audits available into future years, so that's how we would address that.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I think we'll go to Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I really appreciate this report, and I think, you know, when we were drafting this bill, one of the reasons we asked for this report and put it in is because there was a lot of confusion about what it would cost. It was a new program. UI is not a new program, and this is sort of the last exclusion left, and so we had some data, but we looked at Illinois and other things, and so I appreciate this and also the speed with which you guys, which you did it, and so I look forward to using this data. And I want to just clarify the numbers, just because I'm a lawyer, not a numbers person. What I heard us saying is that, and I'm looking, I'm maybe going to look to you, Tim Strom, and you all, that the resources we put in the UI reimbursement account, the $135 million, which will be there until they're exhausted, will likely, if sort of things are on track, be there until the end of fiscal year 2026. Is that correct?
Director Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't at this time project that the full amount could cover 26, but there would be, we think, some funds available in fiscal year 26.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. And so when that runs out, like two and a half years later, then, and this is, I think, what I'm looking to Tim Strom, because I spent a lot of time this fall figuring out what we had to do with the budget in the spreadsheet because of the interaction with the SPED cross-subsidy. We had to budget for those, and I want to make sure I'm saying this right, but those paras who are working in special ed who would be picked up on the formula. Is that right, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, and Ms. Beckel may want to comment on this as well. The money that was built in last year during the conference committee on the special ed and was built in under the assumption about how much it would take to fund unemployment insurance. So there are big numbers. The number Ms. Beckel mentioned was the $64 million built in there, but that was reflective of the $135 million cost estimate of that. What happens is there are a whole bunch of formula adjustments and usage adjustments that go into that special education line. So we had an end of session total for special education. We've had a November and now a February forecast estimating each year through 27 special education numbers. So that original estimate, even though it was tracked during the conference committee, changed just as other forecast estimates, things like the pupil counts and the meal counts and things like that, all of those get adjusted through the forecast process. So it's essentially money lost or gained into the forecast adjustment, saying, well, our estimate wasn't as good as it should have been. Sometimes the number goes down and sometimes it goes up. But that's sort of the short answer on that. If you want the details of the $64 million, Ms. Beckel, I don't know if we've salvage those from our memories from last conference committee on what years we had those applied to.
Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, so I believe the reason we had the 64, I'm sorry, the reason the bill had 64 million, the spreadsheet for the bill had $64 million set aside per year in the tails for a total of $128 million in fiscal years 26 and 27 was because we were factoring in that one-year delay for special education reimbursement. And we had to operate off of the assumption from the fiscal note, which suggested that 1 year's worth of the unemployment insurance changes would amount to $135 million in 1 year only. So because that $135 million was, under these assumptions, going to be gone after the first year, that meant that, as Ms. Erickson said, 100% of the reimbursements, as long as there were funds in that, would go to the unemployment account. But we assumed then that 100% would be gone after the first year. Thus, fiscal year 25 was the lag year. Fiscal year 26 was the year that we expected roughly $64 million, or a bit less than half of the what we anticipated as yearly costs would kick in through the special education reimbursement. So obviously, we now know that that is not the case. So I believe that is why Ms. Erickson referenced that 100% of the unemployment account would, or that reimbursements would be 100% out of the unemployment insurance account through part of fiscal year 26.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and so I think that in my layman's brain, what we're saying is, and I think we have revised down both the amount of money this costs, and I want to talk about that in a second, because it's been 3 years of my life in that world, but two, the base. And so, and what that base means is that baked into the base forecast for our budget is nearly half of the cost to districts of this program, because it is special ed, it will be coded special ed once the reimbursement account is fully exhausted. And I think that was something actually it took me a minute to really make sure to understand. But as we think to our districts and what the cost of the districts will be, you know, 100% is funded until the reimbursement count runs out. It will now be 2.5 years because or around there. But if the this year is a guide, and then after that, we already have baked into the base forecast, because of the intersection with special ed, nearly half of the cost of this program. So I wanted to bring us back, because this is a lot of folks in this room are going to tell us how important this has been to their life. When I first started working on this, the fiscal note for this said that in 1 year it was going to cost $323 million. In 2022, the estimate of the fiscal note was $162 million. And in 2023, when we passed it, the estimate was $135 million a year. We had actually, and we had done some work with some nonprofits who really looked at, and some national folks who looked at Illinois' experience, and we thought the number in 2021 was going to be closer to 25, 30, and I think if you look at inflation to 2023, it was about there, like maybe $5 million over what we had estimated, but nearly $100 million under. We are both coming in nearly $100 million under, based on what I think we knew about the way that workers use this and would use this, and also it sounds like almost $40 million under in the base. And I think that that's really important, and because when we hear about the impact of this program, right, when we hear about what it means, which is, and I don't know if you've been hearing from the workers in your district, but paras who are staying, bus drivers who are now able to go, and I think we're going to hear some of those voices. So when we talk about the READ Act and investments in literacy, what we're doing is making sure that there's actually paras and literacy support staff to help those students, paras that we have been losing to other jobs over the summer. And so I think, like, we are not just talking about a critical social safety net for the workers who are the lowest paid and most vulnerable in our schools. We're also talking about being able to implement all of those values for our kids, literacy values, ensuring that kids have a safe space.
Representative Greenman, I'm going to just cut you off for a second. I know Representative Altener might want to talk too. We have a testifier that has to go back to their classroom because they're one of those essential paras. So I want to go to the quick testimony, and then we'll come back. Director Erickson, can you stay around for a minute in case there's any other questions? We just have five quick testifiers, but I want to make sure this one can speak. So we have Courtney Hamas, paraprofessional from Zimbrota Mazepa on remote. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Courtney Hamas, a Zimbrota Mazepa paraprofessional. I'm also a union vice president and a member rights advocate. I have worked as a paraprofessional at Zimbrota Mazepa for 12 years. I did 10 years in special education and now switched to a media center paraprofessional. I'm also on a new team this year called the behavioral team. This summer was the first summer I had the opportunity to collect unemployment. This summer was also the first summer I felt a mental break that I feel so needed. Instead of working three jobs this summer, I was able to work just one. The unemployment was such a huge help. It was
Sorry, folks, we're having a few technical... Oh, here she goes. No, I think it was... Sorry, folks, I think we have a little technical difficulties here. Ms. Hamas, we have to take a break. You might not be able to hear us. We're reconnecting here. Well, maybe we could have the next two testifiers come down to the table while we're waiting to get the remote back up. We have Sarah Cook, who's a parent from Roseville, and Don Petersdorf from Stewart. Oh, here she's back up. Ms. Moss, we just lost you for a minute because technical difficulties on our end. Oop, and we lost you again. We'll figure this out. So why don't we go to Sarah Cook, and then we'll go to Don Petersdorf, and then on deck is Lisa Zach and Kat Briggs. You can both come down at the same time so we can get moving. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Youakim and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify today about the life-changing legislation that you passed last year, and I want to also thank Representative Greenman for championing this bill. My name is Sarah Cook, and I am the parent of a special needs student in the Roseville School District. As some of you might know, routine and stability are really important to my son Miles and to students like him. Just like many of us, children with special needs feel more confident and secure when their daily activities and the people who help them and lead those activities are familiar and predictable. Research has also consistently shown that confident, secure students learn better. In elementary school, Miles and my family were fortunate enough to have the same special education paraprofessional with him from kindergarten through fifth grade. Miss Beth knew Miles and our family inside and out. She knew that redirection was the best way to get Miles to come inside from recess if he refused, and that talking about Star Wars, Marvel, superheroes, or Minecraft helped him calm down when he gets upset. She also knew what he was capable of and pushed him when needed. Miles loved Miss Beth like a family member, and so did we. Unfortunately, what we experienced with Miss Beth is extremely rare, and it hasn't happened since. Miles is now a freshman in high school. Most families, like mine, experience a lot of instability with their child's special education team. We never know who will be there year to year. More than likely, at least one para will choose to keep working their summer job at Walmart or Pizza Hut instead of returning to the job they love because it is a bigger and more stable paycheck. Making paras and other hourly school workers eligible for unemployment insurance in the summer is helping keep more of them in the profession and giving kids like my son Miles more stability in the classroom. I've heard stories in my district of paras not having to work multiple jobs in the summer, this past summer, just to make ends meet, and coming back to school in the fall feeling recharged instead of exhausted and stressed about their finances. I've also heard of entire teams coming back to the classroom for the first time in more than a decade. That's incredible. The financial safety net provided by unemployment insurance is making a difference. Thank you again for passing this life-changing financial safety net last year. Hourly school workers keep our schools running, and they deserve all the support and economic security we can give them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And members, I just ask folks to keep it tight to 2 minutes. And then also thank you all for being super flex with the cart. We are going to also be flipping the bills. Representative Newton's been here for a while. So after we're done with this and some questions, we'll go to House File 4453. But with that, I'll go ahead, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dawn Petersdorf. I am a proud First Student bus driver and union shop steward for Teamsters Local 638. I've worked for First Student for 14 years, and as you all know, up until the summer of 2023, I could not collect unemployment during the summer months. Our work during the summer is limited, and not everyone is available to drive. Even if you are able to get driving routes, they are limited hours, and there is still a full month without work. Having to figure out how to cover expenses ahead of the school year is very difficult. Because of the lack of work, there is a lot of turnover, making it not only hard to retain drivers, but causes us to come up short for drivers while taking more time to train new people. I have been fortunate to be able to drive in the summer. This incredible policy allowed me to supplement the summer school hours that weren't enough to cover my expenses. The final month where there is no school, I was able to collect unemployment and continue recovering from an injury from the previous year. My coworkers and I were able to simply survive the summer rather than scramble to keep food on the table and the lights on and keep a roof over our heads. I am grateful to the legislators who worked so hard to get this bill passed and for all your work to maintain this necessary benefit for hourly school employees. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we have Courtney Hamas still online to finish the last minute of her testimony. Nope, she had to go back to school. So now you are all getting a taste of what it's like to be a paraprofessional in our schools. And I think my training as a para has helped me do this. But we do have Lisa Check remotely. Why don't you go ahead and state your name for the record, and then Kat Briggs is up on deck. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Lisa Zeck. I'm a field service support technician for St. Paul Schools, and I've worked in the district for about 20 years. My job is to make sure all the technology at two schools function properly. So I fix the laptops, the iPads, all the technology that helps learning happen. And I wanted to provide some insight to how important it was for me and for my coworkers to finally have access to unemployment insurance last summer. The unpaid summer period is 6 to 8 weeks long, and there aren't very many short-term opportunities in technology for full-time, well-paid work. So I've pretty much always had to plan for my income to decrease by about 75% as I would piece together some kind of work for the summer until mid-August when I went back to work. Thankfully, I haven't had to face some of the really dire situations that some of my coworkers have that caused them to leave public service and find other careers. But the unemployment insurance really mattered for my family. I had stability over the summer months last summer. I came into this school year a lot better for it. For the first time, I'm able to use my savings for a trip instead of just saving the income to pay bills over the summer and pay for unexpected expenses. And not to mention that our paychecks are quite a bit lower for the second half of every school year anyway, because we have to pay for our summer insurance coverage. So this change, as groundbreaking as it was, doesn't mean that our goals of a living wage for all workers, a safe learning environment for all students and staff, or a strong, good faith relationship with the district leadership have gone to the wayside. But your passage of UI for K-12 workers really buoys us every day, especially for those of us that might have left over the summer if we didn't have this safeguard. And we thank you for it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And last up, Kat Briggs, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Kat Briggs. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. I've testified for years in support of changing the law to allow education support professionals to access unemployment in the summer. This past summer, I'm so proud to say we got it. Driving a bus isn't an easy job. We're basically driving a one-room schoolhouse through traffic. It's extra tough in the summer, and not just because there's no air conditioning. During summer school, I work 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon. 4 days a week, that's only 16 hours of work. And of course, there's no work in the weeks when there's no school. Because of the change that we fought for and won, in the weeks when there was school, I received partial unemployment benefits. The weeks when there were no routes, I received full benefits. I didn't have to choose between taking care of my kids, and as you know now, my bus, my kids, and my grandbabies. Four of my eight grandchildren have summer birthdays. I used to stress about buying presents and affording the gas to go visit them. Because of UI, I was able to care for my grandchildren, as well as making sure my 89-year-old mother was settled in after moving from Oregon to Minnesota. And yes, she has transitioned great and is enjoying the state of Minnesota. The little bit of financial security provided by UI over the summer months has helped four generations of my family. It is not only my life that UI has played an important role. People I work with and in my district tell me how this law has changed their lives too. They can afford to do the work they love as well as care for their loved ones. They no longer fear going without or having to leave a profession they love. The work we did together made such a difference to so many people. To everyone in the room who had a part in that, I thank you.
Thank you. And tell your mother that winters usually have snow, so not to get used to this.
She moved here in January, so she got a blast of it last year. So thank you.
Members, we're going to have a hard stop at 11:30 to move on to other bills, but I want to give a chance to Representative Altendorf. You had your name on the roster, and then Representative Greenman, and then we'll finish.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chair Joachim. And to Representative Greenman, I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about reality here when, it seems very much like the majority party wants to take a victory lap on this one. And when you're talking about the numbers, I mean, is this really an accurate amount of time when we're looking at this was just passed at the end of May And we are looking at one summer, one small group of data. This is not fair to our schools. This is not fair to our superintendents. This is not fair to our school board members who are struggling right now with teacher contracts to be taking this victory lap and to say that this is so under budget. Just this week, I talked to a district of my school, and they said, looking at next year, they already know that this unemployment insurance is going to be three times what they paid out this summer. And so for you to say that this was so over-budgeted, underfunded, when we were looking at this very, very small data point, this is not reality, members. We are not looking at realistic numbers. We cannot look at one little tiny drop and claim that this is going to be this great program. So we're taking this victory lap today, and yet we're asking valid questions in support of our schools, in support of our superintendents, and asking them, how is this going to be funded in the future? This is a very serious deal. This is a large part of their budget, large part of the general fund that we are taking away from the schools, and I really, really think that this victory lap is a little bit premature.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. As a reminder, the schools have paid nothing out for this so far. And we're not going to, kind of skating on the edge of putting words in people's mouths. So let's just be respectful with each other at the table, and we will all try our best. And Representative Greenman, real quick, so we can go on to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to call attention to the most important budget here is what Dawn and Lisa and Kat and Courtney said, which is a budget that they can now afford their lives. And it's the same budget, and it's the same social safety net that other Minnesota workers already have and rely on. And I think that that, for all of us, I don't care what party you're in, should be a victory that we are providing that economic stability to Minnesotans. The last thing I will say, and I think Lead Krisha was going, is I do think that there's a good and important conversation about after the fund runs out, and just to reiterate what the chair said, $135 million exists. This wasn't one piece of data. I think what MDE said is 99% of districts reported they're getting reimbursed, and that's those are real numbers. That's facts. And to the point about what we do after that fund runs out, you know, about 50% of the cost is baked into the special ed or to the SPED. But I do think if we're talking about how we can move our districts to have more support in the summer, more learning support, that is something that I think there's probably bipartisan support for. I know that the workers I talk to, UI is only a partial wage replacement. It's only half their work. And when folks are making $20,000 a year, they want to be working full-time in the districts too. What you hear is they can't. And I think if there's opportunities to fund and make sure that our districts can provide full-time work in the summer, I think it's good for workers, I think it's good for our kids, and I think it's good for our districts. And so I'm really looking forward to the conversation about how we can provide that flexibility to really get to a place where those folks can work full-time doing the jobs they love, and that's the stories we've been hearing for the last couple of years. So I appreciate the conversation, look forward to more after I think we're talking about the next biennium or that. And just again, thank you for all of those workers. I will say I think Kat has been here longer than I've been in the legislature, and so really just appreciate it's because of you all that we got this done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman, and thank you for reminding us that this is an ongoing conversation. We know we're going to have to talk about this in the next budget cycle, and we're going to be doing that in collaboration with our school districts. With that, members, we have up next House File 4453. Representative Newton, thank you for sticking with us for some fun and education finance. I bet you miss it. As a former school board member as well.
Yeah.
Representative Newton, why don't you go ahead? I will move House File 4453 before committee, and I believe you have a DE2 amendment.
That's correct, Madam.
Why don't we go ahead and put that on so the bill gets in the shape that you'd prefer to speak about it. So, members, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. The DE2 amendment has been adopted. And with that, we have House File 4453 before us with the DE2 amendment. And members, we will be, the motion is to lay this over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Newton, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Yolkin and members. And I, first, I'd like to preface this by thanking Tim Strom, who's been pulling my irons out of the fire for more than 16 years on school issues, and you as well, Madam Chair, for working with Chair Kunesh in the Senate on this bill. House File 4453 provides that twice a year, let me give you some background. Twice a year, the Minnesota Department of Education distributes the school endowment payments from the Permanent School Trust Fund to the public schools and charter schools of the state. This endowment distribution ran about $49 million last year. I think it was about $58 per student for every school. One of the issues that we're dealing with in this particular bill is that the four public tribal contract schools do not receive this funding. And so we're looking to add those four tribal contract schools to the funding. We're talking about 620 students and roughly $36,000 a year in distribution. And it's an issue of fairness, Madam Chair. And with that, I don't know if I have...
Yes, we do have Lori Harper here, Director of Education, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and the Chair of the Tribal Nations Education Committee, which we lovingly call TNAC. So with that, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Lori Harper. I have a map that I would love to share. And I'm at that age where I have to wear readers, so.
Sorry. Yeah. Did you have the map as copies? Because I'm not sure we'll be able to get to the technology for you to be able to see that.
I don't have copies of it, but okay. I can.
Maybe we can just provide it to us after the fact, unless we can get the technology going. So why don't you go ahead and start your testimony as our CA works on that. Mr. Strom, while we're doing this, why don't you quickly go ahead and walk through the DE2 to let folks know what's in it.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton and members, the DE2 you just adopted, the purpose of that was to change the payment stream to state general fund dollars in the same amount as the permanent school fund dollars. This addresses some nervousness about the constitutional language regarding the payment of permanent school fund monies, but the net effect to the four tribal contract schools is exactly the same. The same dollar amount would flow to them on the same schedule as the money that flows to the districts and charter schools, as Representative Newton explained. And that most recent year-end data, as he mentioned, just came out the other day, and it's about $60 per pupil this year for the permanent school fund distribution.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. That helps. Looks like we still have some technical difficulties. You just want to start with your presentation, why we work on that? Thank you. So go ahead and state your name for the record.
Lori Harper.
Thank you.
Ani Nogabe Wasikwe, Indigena Kaz, Gasa Gaswajame Kag and Dunjaba, Gamaskwawa Kokaga and Dayan, Nupaming and Daya. Good morning, Chair Yukaim. And Vice Chair Mary Frances Clardy, thank you. It was wonderful to see you last night and meet you last night at the MCT Legislative Dinner. Good morning, Representative Ron Kresha and the rest of the committee. I'm Lori Harper. I'm the Director of Education for Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm also the Tribal Nations Education Committee Chair. Leech Lake Nation is located in north central Minnesota and shares land with the counties of Beltrami, Cass, Hubbard, and Itasca. I'm here today to express the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe's support, as well as the Tribal Nations Education Committee's support of House File 4453, School Endowment Fund Apportionment The school endowment fund, as it is referred to by the Minnesota Department of Education, or the permanent school fund, as it is titled on the Minnesota DNR websites, is a trust fund created by the Minnesota Constitutional Article 11, Section 8, and designated as a long-term source of revenue for public schools. The fund consists of A, the proceeds of lands granted by the United States for the use of schools within each township, B, the proceeds derived from swamp lands granted to the state, C, all cash and investments credited to the permanent school fund, N, to the swamp land fund, and D, all cash investments credited to the internal improvement land fund and the lands therein. Lands that benefit the permanent school fund are known as school trust lands. Proceeds from school trust lands are generated through mining royalties, timber sales, land sales, and various leases. This is an excerpt from the Minnesota the MMB Permanent School Fund report dated September 2020 to August 2021. 92% of the remaining trust land surface acres are located in the northern part of Minnesota. Statewide, there are 2.5 million acres of school trust land surface. The total acreage of Beltrami, Cass, Hubbard, and Itasca counties is 534,650 acres, or 23.06% of the trust land, and it is located on the Leech Lake Nation lands and in our ceded territories. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe and TNEC supports House File 4453 School Endowment Fund Apportionment Proposed Language to be more inclusive. That reads line 1.9 in participating schools and American Indian schools as defined in section 124D.73 and line 1.11 participating school and American Indian schools. Miigwech Pisendowiak, thank you.
Thank you very much, Director Harper. With that, members, I think we'll move to the table for any questions. Lead Krisha.
Thank you, and I'll be quick. And so thank you, Director, for being here, and of course, Representative Newton. You know I have to support your bill just because of you, so you win with that. And I would just say that I think this is a great opportunity for us to continue to explore how we might have equalization between non-public and public and the efforts you have. And so to the director, I support your efforts as well. And thank you, Representative Newton, for bringing this bill.
Thank you. Any other further questions or comments from the table? Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you, Representative Newton, and our tribal members that are here today. I don't have any questions. I just want to highlight a conversation that happened yesterday while we were all breaking bread in circle with District 2 Representative White Earth Nation's Eugene Somers. In a question that I had asked him, what can we do from the state in our positions to support our tribal nations? And it all went to supporting education and supporting our youth, that's how we can bring restorative healing, how we can recognize history, how we can honor the ancestors and the people of this land, but also how we can create the leadership of education and opportunity through the next seven generations. So thank you for bringing this and for mapping it out as best as you could, and for the continued all tribal education and youth programming that we deserve to fight for, whether we're there, whether we're tribal members or not, but that we're recognizing the true leadership of what's going to be from the land of the people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Newton, final comments.
I have no final comments other than to say, working with, I'm chair of the School Trust Commission, and Senator Mary Kunish is the vice chair. And one of our goals is to actually return all of the school trust lands to the tribes so that they will eventually have full control over all the trust lands, all the swamp lands. So. With that, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. With that, House File 4453, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. And then next up, we have House File 4500. Vice Chair Clardy, once you get settled, you can go ahead and move 4500 before the committee with the intention of re-referring this bill to higher ed. So, members, we will be having a vote. This bill is going to higher ed for the higher ed provisions that are in it. They combine the bills this year. in the past, we've had TOCAC kind of moving separately, but it's a smaller ask, so they wanted to have a bill together. And we'll just go ahead and push another chair up so that we can have both the testifiers ready to go. Go ahead, Representative Clardy, move House File 4500 before us.
So move.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, great. As a teacher for 28 years, I can assure you this bill has a special importance to me, not only being a teacher of color, but having a daughter that entered the school system. And for me, it was a clear need. So it's not just the BIPOC community that benefits from having teachers of color, but it's like all the community. So that's why I'm here to support and author this bill. This bill is not brand new. It is a new version. So this is the 8th legislative session that it's been presented in, and it's been authored by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So we made lots of gains last year as far as like some historic investments. And in addition, the policy provisions in the omnibus bill helped ensure that there are solid returns on the investments. So the two main purposes of this bill is closing the opportunity gaps as far as like recruiting and preparing teachers and employing them and retaining them in the system, and also increasing investments in three impactful programs, which would be one-time funding. And it would also meet the official state goal stated in 120B.117. By increasing teachers of color by 2% a year, so that in 2040 we will have the teaching population look very diverse and look like our students in the system. So there are three strategic one-time investments that are going on. The first one is aspiring teachers of color, and this bill appropriates money from both education finance and in higher education. Thus, we are referring this bill to them later. So it would be for $10 million, five would be from each committee. And it serves the needs of E-12 and higher education. It also establishes the needed scholarship program that's in statute with some minor edits on the language from 2023 for higher education to increase the teachers of color. And then also, like right now, there's about 2,000 BIPOC teacher candidates that are enrolled in preparation programs. So this proposed investment from our committee would provide about 500 annual scholarship up to $10,000 as an investment in aspiring BIPOC teachers. The second one is the teacher mentorship and retention grants. And this bill seeks an addition one-time appropriation of $5 million for fiscal year 2025. And $9 million would be requested from 47 applicants. And then finally, the collaborative urban greater Minnesota Educator Grants, COGMAT. And I should know that one because I was a Q teacher myself. So this bill seeks an additional one-time appropriation of $1 million for fiscal year 25. So, and I have some testifiers here, Chair.
Thank you. We'll go to the testifiers. Quantel Crawford, why don't you go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman and members. Thank you for coming to hear us out today. My name is Quantel Crawford, and I am a teacher candidate at the University of St. Thomas's graduate level Suter program, which is paired with St. Paul Public Schools. This means I take classes full-time as well as work full-time as a special education teacher in St. Paul's Public School Hazel Park Preparatory Academy over on the east side of St. Paul. Growing up, I was fortunate enough to have parents who valued contributing to their community by dedicating their life's work toward advocating for the well-being of their neighbors, friends, and family. As a social worker for the Ramsey County my mother taught me the value of helping others navigate complex social systems in order to advocate for themselves and their needs in life. As the president of the North Area Football Association, I saw my dad's leadership, love, and creativity change how 10 plus years of hundreds of St. Paul public or St. Paul youth think of themselves, adding value to the important societal concepts such as goal setting, teamwork, and working hard in order to accomplish your goals. All I've ever wanted to do in my life was make my parents proud. Now, due to the blessing that has come in the form of the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship, I'm able to overcome the staggering financial difficulties previously preventing me from pursuing my dreams, namely my dream of making my parents proud by taking the torch they lit and keeping the flame alive, acting as a leader in my St. Paul community. This is something I would not have been able to afford if it weren't for the scholarship's financial contribution. In fact, this is not my first attempt at getting my teaching license. During my undergraduate experience, I was a double major in the fields of sociology and education. However, I was forced to drop my education major due to the final student teaching experiences requirement to teach for an entire semester full-time with no financial compensation. I could not afford this, and I was already working full-time to pay for my schooling. Therefore, I implore you to please support the investments proposed in this bill to increase teachers of color. Thank you.
Thank you. And Lakita Bruce, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lakita Bice.
Hi.
And I am a teacher candidate at Metro State University for K through 12 special education licensure. I also work as an English teacher on a Tier 1 license currently at St. Paul City School, which is a charter school located 2 minutes from where we are. I am proud to say that in my current role as an 11th and 12th grade English teacher, many of my students have said, "Miss Lakita, you are my first black teacher." That made my heart warm, but also a bit saddened, because children deserve the right to see a representation of themselves in the teachers that educate them. My hopes is that I encourage them and they are able to see that being a teacher of color is possible. I am also a mother of 5 wonderful children, and as a parent, I wanted to serve as a role model to my children. I knew the key to my family's success would be me graduating from college with my first degree, but now here I am heading going towards I'm in graduate school to earn my Tier 3 teaching licensure. Now, college looks different at 30 plus years old with children. It is challenging working a full-time job, paying bills, all while trying to attain a higher education goal. The academic rigor of college and grad school was not the part I was afraid of. It was the cost. Without scholarships and grants, I would not be able to attain my associate degree that I got from St. Paul College, nor my bachelor's degree in human services that I attained from Metro State University. This semester, I appreciate being awarded scholarships for teacher candidates of color, because it helps me pay for tuition and books. It would be amazing to also receive the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship in the future, with up to $10,000 per year to help towards paying the full cost of attendance as a graduate student and reduce my loan debt. In my school, I see a lot of future educators of color, but we need the investments proposed in this bill to support us becoming well-prepared with Tier 3 licensure. Most of them won't be able to do it without the investment proposed in this bill. Please support the additional funding proposed for the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship Program and other grant programs. Thank you.
And I am so sorry for mispronouncing your name.
No.
And thank you very much both for wanting to go into the teaching profession. With that, members, just a reminder, we're going to be voting on this bill to move it to higher ed so they can take a look at it. We still don't have targets, so we'll still retain the education portion in our committee to look at once we get those targets. So with that, members, are there questions from the table? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I have to tell you, it's so important. It is so important, and I thank you for coming with the lived experience. I have my master's in social work, and we were required to do the same thing, work full-time for free. And I can tell you there were times when I did not know what I was going to eat at night. and how I was going to pay my rent. So I cannot thank you enough for bringing this. It is so important. And so I'm going to sign on as the co-author.
Thank you. And then I saw Lead Krisha, but before I go to Lead Krisha, so you can wrap up, is there anybody else that had any questions? Looking. All right, Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for your work in this. No reason to oppose this. Good luck in higher ed, and I hope you can have positive conversations.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Clardy, final word.
Just thank you for looking forward to the future of children in Minnesota.
Thank you so much. And with that, members, we will go to one of our first few. We've had a vote before. I was going to say it was our first vote, but it's not. With that, Representative Clardy renews her motion that House File 4500 be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. House File 4500 is re-referred to the Higher Education Committee. With that, members, we are meeting again tomorrow here, and make sure you have all 3 days on your calendar next week. And with that, we're adjourned.